It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Leo's off today. I'm Mike Elgin, Twit's news director. Jeff and Gina are here, and we'll be talking about the future of Google, the future of privacy, and we'll talk about the growing power of Google and the other big tech companies as well, and just what should be done about it, if anything. All that and more coming up right now on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 257, recorded July 9th, 2014. Future Babies. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by NatureBox. Order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like Coconut Date Energy Bites. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about Google and the cloud. Leo's on vacation. I'm Twit's news director, Mike Elgin, filling in for Leo this week. We have the usual cast of characters. Jeff Jarvis, the professor of journalism at the City University of New York, and he's coming in from the said City University of New York, right? That's your office.
Are you calling me a character?
Yes.
Hey.
And this is a very character-building show, so I don't blame you. Jeff is the author of Public Parts, What Would Google Do, and Gutenberg the Geek, three very awesome books, which I loved reading. And he blogs at buzzmachine.com, and everyone should go and read that blog all the time because it's really great. And also Gina Trapani, the creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twit's All About Android, and founding editor of Lifehacker. And Gina, Lifehacker, you had an interesting inspiration for that name, didn't you?
I did. This guy named Danny came up with this phrase called life hacks, and he did a talk back in like 2004, and we just loved the idea, and we launched a site based on it. So I kind of owe him a big part of my career. Yeah,
Danny O'Brien. And in related news, we have Danny O'Brien on the show today, here to talk about a really interesting article he wrote this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Danny.
No problem at all. Oh, my goodness, I'm compressing beautifully here. But yes. This is what I look like in real life.
We like that hostage video kind of vibe.
I know, exactly. I should hold up a newspaper that you can't actually make the date out on.
Well, anybody who watches this and doesn't want to remember it, you have the right to forget it. That's our topic today. We want to bring you on because you wrote an article, Danny, called Rights That Are Being Forgotten, a play on the European Union's Right to Be Forgotten ruling. And you and Jillian York wrote this really interesting piece that talked about some of the other things that are being sacrificed in the quest for privacy in Europe under this ruling. And we'd like to talk about it with you for a few minutes, if you like. Now, it's your day off, and I appreciate you coming on today and joining us on your day off. So
it's totally fine. I like talking about this sort of stuff on my day off as well. So we wrote the piece because I think this is one of those examples where there are considerations about privacy and considerations about free speech, and sometimes they butt against one another. And our concern with the way that the right to be forgotten has been interpreted in the CCJ decision and by Google, because I think Google's had a lot of leeway in how it might implement this stuff, has meant that the right of free expression has been kind of missed. And I think that's going to become a bigger problem as more and more companies feel they have to adopt protocols to take into account this decision.
Now, you talked about three victims of this ruling, and I'd like to go through them if you don't mind. The first one was that the first victim, you said, of this ruling is Google's implementation of the ECJ's, the European Court of Justice's, decision, which is transparency under censorship. What did you mean by that? How is transparency under censorship being victimized here?
So let's go back a million or so years to 2001. And Google, in its early idealistic phases, was bumping into some of its first challenges as a big search engine. And that was people in the U.S. coming on and demanding that content be taken down, or in particular, links be taken down. And one of the most controversial of those cases was the Church of Scientology, which up until then had already attracted quite a reputation on the internet as being an organization big enough and concerned enough to demand that content be removed. So Google was trying to work out how to deal with these takedowns, and it set what I thought was an interesting precedent for big companies, in that Google took down the content because they were legally obliged to do so in the United States. But they put a little message at the bottom saying, you've typed in this search term, and we've had to remove some of the results, and click here to find out more. And you clicked there, and you went to Chilling Effects, a great site that EFF is supports, that actually lists the court orders and the DMCA takedown requests that led to this removal. So you could get an idea of why things were being censored, who was doing it, and what the extent was. Something was missing, but you knew it was missing. Google has done a similar thing with the implementation of this European Court of Justice requirement, but they've skipped on this. Actually, what they do is they put that notice at the bottom of search results in Europe, but they put it for everything that looks like a name. So if you type Danny O'Brien into google.co.uk, there will be a little message saying, oh, something might have been removed from this search. And in fact, that's not the case. I mean, I haven't put a request, neither of the 1,500 other Danny O'Briens in the world. It's just that Google has placed that in every single name request.
So as Donald Rumsfeld would say, it used to be a known unknown, and now it's an unknown unknown. And that's a real problem. Now, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Danny O'Brien, who's a technology journalist and civil liberties activist. He's also the international director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Why do you suppose Google is doing that? Is it because they want to get more publicity for the fact that they're being forced to do this? Or is it just hard to do a warning for the specific search results? Or do they just want to not antagonize the European authorities?
Well, so this has been the subject of a lot of press interest, in that, there's been an open question whether Google is implementing this. Some people have said in sort of a deliberately clumsy way in order to increase opposition to it. Or alternatively, they're implementing it in the only way that they know how, and the ruling is as bad as that, and there's nothing they can do about it. I don't have any particular insight into which one this plays out. I mean, I don't see Google as being pure as the driven snow in a lot of these cases. They have their own motivations. And as working at the EFF, one thing I know is if you have your civil liberties decided by a big fight between the courts and a large corporation, it's really not your civil liberties that are being decided. It's what's being decided is, the intent and motives of these companies.
Personally, and I don't know if you agree, Jeff and Gina, but I would love to see those big black bars as if somebody came in there with a Sharpie or something like that, and just so it'd be super obvious and really just mar the appearance of the entire search result.
But of course, the problem with that is that, I mean, and Danny, I agree with you on this. I've spoken about this on the show. And in fact, when I wrote my book, Public Parts, a couple of years ago, I attacked this whole notion started by Viviane Reding of the European Commission of this right to be forgotten, and have raised a flag about the danger to speech that this raises. And now it's only proving to be the case. And last week we talked about Guardian and BBC's stories being taken down. And then since then they went back up. I don't think Google is being cynical in this, but Google is absolutely stuck with a terrible ruling where there's no good way to do this. The irony of it is that many Europeans don't want Google to have more power, and the court only gave Google more power, and more power Google doesn't want in this case. But the Streisand effect irony of this is that if they said specifically, this is exactly what we took down, then of course they're going to get taken to court saying, well, you've just countermanded the point of the ruling and pointed to what was taken down. Google's in a no-win situation here.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, mind reading going on here. Like, Google is says that it's trying to anticipate objections like that and build a system that works that way. Well, if you're in a situation where you're having to mind read the courts, the best thing to do is actually go to the courts and find out. And there are 29 data protection authorities in the EU. And we're in this curious position where Google has jumped in and started implementing this before the authorities have even said.
Danny, this was an unappealable decision. It was a final decision by the highest court, and Google had really no choice but to get going. There's no appeal back to lower authorities separately. The court said, this is a decision. That's it. There is no appeal. There is no choice. You have to do this. The only appeal that's going to come now is through legislators. And we have the Justice Minister of the UK saying today that there is no right to be forgotten. And I think we're going to see this fought out at different levels. But Google, I disagree. Google was stuck with having to go enforce something. And you also said in your piece that Bing is the alternative. As far as I understand the ruling, this was not specific to Google. This is Bing and Yahoo and other search engines that they've got to deal with the same thing. Google is just the first doing it.
Well, I was going to say I don't want to get into like dueling EU scholarship, but why not? Let's do it. So it is true that this is a court of last appeal, as it were. However, it doesn't quite work in the same way as the Supreme Court in the United States. What's happening here is that a lower court has gone up to the European Court of Justice and asked it a bunch of questions. And the European Court of Justice has given an answer to those questions. Now everything else begins to sort of roll out. That court, the lower court, will make a decision based on that answer, and data protection authorities and search engines like Google and like Bing will work out how to implement that. But it's not just a crack of lightning and everything changes. And My concern is really that, like, I actually want to hold the data protection authorities to account, because one of the things that we're profoundly worried about is that the entire regulatory space here is all about protecting privacy, which means that publishers like The Guardian, like the BBC, don't really have an obvious way of appealing this without going and begging Google to put this back. And as you've
said, in fact, there was no requirement that Google had to even notify them. I was delighted that Google notified The Guardian and the BBC of this. And yes, some may say that was a cynical act to get the PR, but whatever. There was, you know, among the 70,000 takedown requests that were there, there was, you know, one's four or five for The Guardian, one for the BBC, and they got notified, which means that they then did have the appeal of going to Google in the court of public opinion, and Google did change. We didn't even know how that was going to work out, whether Google was going to notify anyone that their free speech rights had just been affected by this FACACTA ruling.
And Danny O'Brien, that was your second victim, which is the victim of the implementation of fairness. And you said that, you know, Google, in fact, did go to the people with, as you said, as a bully pulpit, the press, essentially, which raises the question, yes, the press could sort of get Google to make a change, but can people who don't, you know, buy digital ink by the barrel do that? Is it fair that the press has one set of rules and that the little people have a different set? And that was one of your points.
So it's interesting, the nitty-gritty of this particular case. I mean, one thing, and I cut the paragraph out of our essay just because it was getting huge, is that, in fact, the way that Google notifies people, and Jeff's absolutely right, it's great that they're doing this and they didn't have to do this, is through their Google Webmaster Tools system. So basically, if you use Google Analytics and you sign up to their service, you now get a little message when Google is removing links because of a privacy takedown request. This is weird in that it now means that you have to sign up to a Google service in order to find out whether your content is being removed. But the other part of this is that what is the appeal process here? It turns out that when Google put back some news items, it actually put back, I think, one news item that was due to them making a mistake. So it's not actually a sort of legal challenge that we're seeing here. It's just Google, as will inevitably be the case, making an error in its internal system. I mean, we deal with terrible problems with the DMCA copyright takedowns and Google's and other companies' implementation of their legal requirements under that. And at least the DMCA system has a legal method for someone to appeal this decision. And right
Danny,
now,
let me ask you about that. Let me ask you about that, because in a way, I was happy but unhappy that Google turned around and put some of the items back up for whatever reason. Because what I would like to see happen is for the likes of The Guardian and the BBC to bring their own free speech complaints, suits, that their rights have been impinged by this, and that we fight that out in that case. I don't know enough about European law and the structure and how that goes there, so I will concede defeat on any EU scholarship immediately to you. But what would it take? Could you imagine a case going for whether it's The Guardian or whether it's, you know, blogger Joe Schmo or being able to then have a complaint of their civil rights being violated, and how would they bring that?
So what potentially could happen is that we're actually in the middle of reforming the data protection laws in Europe, and it's at a fairly late stage. So conceivably, they could add something to that, which would add a sort of right to appeal. But we're in, as everyone says, incredibly uncharted territories here, because there's never really been this face-off between privacy and free speech within the data protection system like this. And just very quickly, you know, it didn't have to be this way. The Advocate General, who's sort of the research wing, as it were, of the European Court of Justice, published his report before the final decision, and said what actually I think everybody, including Google, thought this decision was going to play out, which is the court saying that Google can't wriggle out of data protection requirements in Europe, but a free expression right trumps the requirement to sort of delete this data from the search index.
Indeed, Danny, I think you're right. I was brought to speak for travel, not for pay, to Google's privacy all hands in Mountain View about a day and a half after this decision came out. And as I said on the show previously, they were gobsmacked. They did not expect this to come. But my European friends, when I was in Berlin a few weeks later, said, oh, well, they should have expected this to come.
I know what I think everybody expected, and again, I've been speaking to people, is that Google had somewhat aggressively challenged the idea that they were susceptible to any European data protection requirements, because they said the Google Search Index is done out of Mountain View, and their Google Spain department just deals with ads. And I don't think that was ever going to fly. And I think what happened is they aggressively said that in the courts. And when this decision came down, a lot of people were so happy about Google actually being obliged to comply with European law that they didn't realize this really counterintuitive decision that the ECJ had sort of tacked on the end.
Danny O'Brien, your third victim in your article and final victim was Europe's privacy law itself. You pointed out that, and you made a really interesting argument about censorship, and that any small step down the road of censorship causes information to essentially route around that censorship, forcing those who want to censor information to have ever more repressive forms of censorship. And then you go down into the wormhole of, you know, totalitarian dictatorship or something like that. But this is clearly a step towards censorship, right? And this kind of, that's the part of this that to me came kind of out of nowhere, that Europe would not only take a big step, what I think is a big step toward censorship, did it in such a clumsy way, did it in a way that seemed to be an available way. You can't just, you know, it would have been an entirely different proposition for them to go and have the articles removed from the Guardian website, for example.
Right.
And so this was the kind of a weaselly way, in my opinion, a kind of a weaselly way for them to get a similar effect. But as you point out, it's a step toward of censorship in an otherwise generally free society. What's next, do you think?
Well, the reason why we said that was because I'm really used to speaking to governments who have, in their eyes, a perfectly reasonable reason to try and censor and block content online. I mean, when we deal with, as we often do at the EFF, with the copyright industry, they'll say, you know, that we have an whole industry hanging on this. Piracy is rampant. And therefore, we need to use this censorship tool to prevent our industries collapsing. Same thing when I talk to the Thai government and they say, you know, we're in an environment where the country is being riven by civil unrest. We have to block and censor political speech. And the same thing's happening here. And all you can say in all of these cases is, look, this isn't going to work. And when you discover that it isn't going to work, you're going to double down, right? And this is what we saw with the copyright industry. And this is what we see in any country that tries to control what its people see. And the problem with that is you end up with this ridiculous situation where you have incredible fines changing the entire internet infrastructure to comply with censorship requirements, and it still doesn't work. Essentially,
well said,
everything,
Danny. Well said.
Everything that's being removed from Google's index is still out there. And I and any other person who knows how to put together a script could write you a program that would find it. And in fact, of course, we've just highlighted what is seen as being valuable content by doing that. So it's not going away, and you can't half censor. Half censoring is like being half pregnant. It just doesn't work. And then we just go down this slippery slope.
All right. Well, Danny O'Brien is a technology journalist and civil liberties activist at the EFF and also the international director of said EFF. Thank you so much for coming on This Week in Google and telling us and discussing your article with us.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you, Danny.
All right, man.
And Danny, don't send any cease and desist letters to Gina about Lifehacker, okay?
It's like, you know, the last guy on earth.
Yeah, you're right. The last person who can do that, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Curse you, Gina.
All right.
Thanks, Danny. You're
thanks
the
again.
Best.
Thanks Thank again, you. Danny. Well, in just a sec, we're going to talk about more instances. I think the theme of the show is probably going to be the overwhelming and growing power of companies like Google and other technology giants, especially cloud-based giants. And we're going to talk about that in a sec. But first, I want to tell you about our sponsor today, which is NatureBox. I have a box of Nature right here. And the NatureBox is an awesome subscription healthy snack service that is fantastic for a whole bunch of ways. And it's a kind of a googly business model, and I'll tell you why in just a sec. But first, I want to tell you about some of these snacks that they have. Lone Star, I was eating this before the show, and we couldn't start the show until I finished chewing. It's really delicious stuff. Basically, Nature Box snacks have zero trans fats, zero high fructose corn syrup. Leo says fructose. I say fructose. Doesn't matter. There's
you're,
zero.
You're right. You're
Am
right.
I right? Okay, good.
You're right.
You tell Leo that when next time he's back from vacation. Fructose. Let's hear for fructose. And also nothing artificial. If you're going to snack on something healthy. One of the reasons people eat unhealthy snacks is they shop at the store when they're hungry. And then when you're hungry, you see potato chips and all this other stuff, and you buy junk food, and then it's in the house, and then you get hungry, and then you eat junk. With NatureBox, they'll always make sure you have healthy snacks, very convenient, right there in your house. What they do is they send great-tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the United States. You just go to the site and click on the Continue button to choose between 3 subscription options, then place your order. Once you're a member, this is a membership snack service, you can select which snacks you like in your monthly box. Now, this is the googly part of all this. Google has a tendency to be very experimental. They throw all kinds of stuff against the wall to see what sticks. They throw lots of products out there, and the ones that don't really work, they pull back. The ones that do work, they build into gigantic services like Gmail and these other things. And that's what NatureBox does as well. You can keep trying different services. The ones you like, you can go on the website and say, I want to keep getting those, but keep surprising me with new ones. They have more than 100 delicious, healthy choices that you can choose from. And you can also select by dietary needs. So if you're a vegan, if you don't want soy, if you're gluten conscious, if you're lactose intolerant, you don't want nuts, you have a nut allergy or something like that, and you can also choose non-GMO. Whatever it is, you can just simply select that on the website, and they'll only show you the products that suit your dietary needs. You can also select by taste, savory, sweet, or spicy. I love them all, but your mileage may vary. So the next time you get cranky and hungry and are ready to eat anything, don't eat anything. Eat Nature Box snacks. They have snack guilt-free snacks like coconut date energy bites, Santa Fe corn sticks, pear praline crunch. I haven't tried that one. I'm going to have to try that one. That sounds good. We've got them around the office here all the time. And, you know, people talk about this as like, maybe I can get this for myself. I can get a subscription for myself. If you got a kid in college, this is a great option to make sure that they get healthy snacks that just keep on coming. And I know a lot of Silicon Valley startups that use Nature Box, because otherwise somebody has to go to Costco and buy a bunch of junk food. This way it just comes to the office and it's office snacks for everybody. And again, they are healthy. And so you don't have this ever growing unhealthy staff. So to get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of This Week in Google.
And now, let me thank Twit for having sent us boxes of this stuff. My favorite so far from what I got are the kettle kernels. I've gone through them all. So the peppery pistachio.
Huh.
And dried pineapple. Those are to die for.
I
got a lot of points when that box arrived at our house. It was like, all right. All that time you spent talking in your computer, worth it, because we got these snacks.
Unbelievable. Look at this one. Sweet blueberry almonds. Blueberry almonds.
Ooh.
Never even heard of that before. That looked fantastic.
Yeah, good.
So do I have to give these back? Can I keep this whole box? Okay.
What else is in there? Is there anything else in there?
Yeah, let's see. Let's see here. We have roasted garlic pumpkin seeds.
Ooh, I'll do that.
Cranberry almond bites. These are basically, this is like where you eat a lot of stuff, but you're really not eating that much. Great for it. And praline pumpkin seeds. We looked at that one. Oh. Yeah, and I've never even seen any of these. There's so many different flavors. I actually, don't tell anyone, but I actually have a couple of bags of these kind of like fig. They're fig bars. One is blueberry, one is fig. And they're just so good. Each one is individually wrapped. Really good. Really enjoy that. Well, back to the show. Now, you may have heard about Vinod Khosla's fireside chat with Sergey and Larry, the founders of Google. And it was a really interesting conversation. It lasts about 45 minutes. And they talked about a whole bunch of things. Some of them were actually kind of funny, which is that in the very early days of Google, when Sergey and Larry and two other people were the grad students who collectively made up the whole of Google, they were actually offered an acquisition proposition by Vinod Khosla himself. And at the time, he was, I guess, advising Excite. If you recall, if you've been around long enough, you remember Excite was a major search engine, I guess, in 1999. In this conversation, they disagreed about the amount that was offered. Khosla said that they offered $350,000 to buy Google, if you can imagine. And the Google founders remember it being over $1 million. Either way, the acquisition didn't happen. And I think everyone in the conversation agreed that that was a good thing because now, of course, Google makes tens of billions of dollars.
Can you imagine if Google had died with Excite?
Oh, man. What a different world.
Well, I wonder how many startups have died in an acquisition. You know, how many startups that would have been destined for greatness otherwise.
That we'll never know about, ever, because they were killed in acquisition. And in fact, that's one of the things that, you know, I worry about. Some of these serial acquisition type companies like Yahoo, they're constantly acquiring companies. Then they make you forget them. And then like four or five years later, they announce that they're closing it. And you're like, I kind of remember that site from years ago. And it just seems so unnecessary. You never know if there's going to be some brilliant ideas in there. But the Google founders had some interesting ideas that they talked about. And they generally expressed their dissatisfaction with the pace of society, with the fact that people work as hard as they do and spend as much time as they do with computers, given what they get back from those computers. And so it's a really interesting conversation. I don't know if you guys had any additional thoughts about this. There were some aspects of it that were controversial. For example, Sergey Brin expressed a comfort level with robots taking over your job that some press outlets took umbrage at. But his point was that, you know, if we have more automation and more robots doing things, then we can all do things that are more enjoyable.
I thought it was ironic that they were suggesting a 4-day work week to help solve the employment issues. And as you said just a minute ago, they think we're working too much. But who are the hardest people, working people you know? Googlers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're there constantly.
Right. They have 4-day work days, some of them. It's a brutal place to work. And of course, they give free food and beverages to all their employees, and they have dry cleaning and massages and all that stuff so that people never have to leave the Googleplex. I guess they could start right there at home. Well, it was an interesting conversation. And toward the end of the interview, they talked about, you know, society and that sort of thing. This is one of the themes of this show, I think we're going to find out, which is that, you know, Google is such a powerful company. And when they say things like this, people tend to freak out. And probably, you know, maybe they should, because, you know, Google has so much power. And that's where we get to our next story, which is that there was an article in Salon suggesting that Google and some of the other big tech giants be nationalized.
This is my nominee. I put it up there. This is my nominee for the dumbest article of the decade.
Okay. What it says is
that we should nationalize Google because it's too powerful, and Amazon because it's too powerful. And by the way, they got started with government's help on the internet, so we own it anyway. To which my response is, then nationalize Tang because it started in NASA. You know, it's just what didn't start with government help is that the point of society is that we have this help out there. It's just I feel a little ashamed of myself putting it up because it is clickbait, but I just wanted to have the chance to say,
yeah, that's all. so let's actually talk about that. And so, do you support the continued ownership by the government of the U.S. Postal Service, for example, Jeff?
Well, I end up doing a lot of work on that topic because I helped a friend of mine named John Callen. In the past, I helped him organize a conference called Postal Vision 2020. And it's not really owned by the government. And indeed, no, I would say that the primary benefit of the Postal Service is it gives a everywhere delivery guarantee. But that could be handled through a subsidy, as phone service is handled through a subsidy to remote areas. And so it's never going to happen. They're never going to get rid of it because there's too many votes there. But no, I don't think we should be in the Postal Service business anymore. And indeed, when we had the Postmaster General at this event a year ago, he said that the primary job of the Postal Service now is as an ad delivery medium. So the Postal Service basically competes with our business right here. And that's not the job of the U.S. government.
One of his arguments is that the big tech companies, including Google through YouTube was singled out, but also Amazon and others, they abuse their power. And because they abuse their power, they need to be nationalized. I can't say it with a straight face either. But do we agree that there's a lot of abuse of power, at least, and that something more needs to be done regarding their abuse of power?
So let's hand it over to the people who run the NSA. Yeah, that'll work.
Well, there's a big left-right. There's always a left-right component to this. In general, people on the left tend to trust government more than private companies, and on the right, vice versa.
I'm a Hillary Clinton Democrat, and I think it's full of crap.
Yeah.
So I've said enough. Gina?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
I agree with you. This seems crazy. Yeah, I mean, I think there are issues that we discuss on this show quite a bit about some of the things that these big companies do, wielding their power. But I don't think this is the solution.
Yeah, I think the biggest flaw in his argument, frankly, is that, you know, I guess the Uber argument that he's making is that the public square, this is so important, the stuff we do online, it's replaced what we used to do in MeetSpace and the public square where we discuss all these things is privatized. The problem with his argument is that there are a million public squares. It's not that Google's public square is the only public square, that Facebook's, that Facebook is the only place where people can have conversations. There are a gazillion places where people can have conversations. And of course, one of the reasons that these companies are so aggressive in doing all these things that he's saying is that they are freaked out that they could be wiped off the mat, go out of business. They all feel like they're 18 months away from complete obsolescence. And in fact, that's true unless they continuously reinvent themselves. And so I think that's one of the reasons why his argument is completely flawed. But it's an interesting
one. You're right, Mike. There's no God-given law that says your company has to live forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the argument that Microsoft made in the 90s when they were being pursued for antitrust for bundling Internet Explorer with Windows. They said, hey, you know, we are. It'd be so easy. We're not a monopoly. Windows is not a monopoly simply because we're just a few months away from everybody just erasing Windows and moving to Linux or whatever. And And in terms of the browser, the reason everybody uses our browser is because it's the best browser. And if somebody else made a better browser, we would decline in market share. And that's exactly what happened.
That's what happened.
Several other companies made better browsers, and Microsoft went right to the bottom. So it's understandable. And of course, you know, it's a Darwinian world in technology. The giants are giants and are still around because they've reinvented themselves, because they've been aggressive about changing users, about changing law, about changing society, and doing all these things. Still, interesting article. I've actually argued in a column before that the wireless carrier should be nationalized, and in exchange we should privatize the post office so that it's a swap, so we don't have a trend in one direction or the other. But I did that simply because of the way pricing works with wireless carriers, and because it's so, you know, many of the incentives tend toward having worse service, and you can't tell what you're paying for. You know, you pay this, you get this monthly contract. Is this a good thing, bad thing, whatever? Anyway, that's another issue unto itself. I'm not generally in favor of privatization, but I thought that was an interesting column because of the theme of you know, all this power that these companies have. So it's really, you know, it's really it was really an interesting piece in the sense that it captured the technical panic.
I got to disagree with you. I think it was an incredibly laughable piece.
Well, it was.
I think it made no sense. It got its facts wrong, by the way, about Google penetration. Yeah. But that aside, I think there was no logic to it. I think that. It's the kind of Luddite talk that we have now is, oh my God, these people are scaring us. Let's try to stop them.
That's why it was interesting. I think it captured the Luddite sensibility that's rising. And you know, I didn't think it was a good piece from a
no, I know we agree, but
it captured the thing that is happening in our society that's just so toxic about just, you know, especially in like San Francisco when people are tearing Google Glass up people's faces,
and all that kind of
stuff. So
it's an encapsulation of techno panic.
Yeah, exactly.
Of all the fears around it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Or I have the new subset of this, which is what I call Euro techno panic. this is America. This is Yank techno panic.
Yeah, we've all got our little variants. So sort of like the soccer friendly, wooden shoe wearing. Never mind. All right. Well, Gina, if the trumpets and the timpanis are ready,
I don't think we need Mike. I think you and I can go home. It looks like the change log is so long today. The show is just headed over to Gina.
So much change to log. This is really impressive. Why don't we go ahead and launch into
the Google change log.
Take it away, Gina.
All right. We got a couple of really cool things this week in the changelog. Google Now, always changing, always getting smarter. A couple of new functions here. First, everybody knows how to use Google Now to set a reminder. You know, remind me at 2:00 to get ready for my meeting. Remind me on Tuesday to meet with whoever. Well, now you can set up occasional reminders. So you can say to Google Now, remind me to take out the garbage occasionally. And it's not clear exactly what occasionally means. It just means
how
that every once in a while,
you?
Yeah, Google will nudge you about taking out the trash.
I don't like this one. I don't like this one.
You don't like this one? It's too ambiguous for you?
No, I don't want to do my chores. I just like, it's one of my best excuses. I forgot, you know, it's like, I don't need this kind of help. You know what I'm saying?
No more excuses. Mm. I haven't had a chance to test this out. I don't know what occasionally means. So I don't know, maybe that's a good thing. But it would be interesting. I would love to know if Google is doing any sort of AI on take out the trash and then making occasionally, you know, every few days or what. Also new, coming soon to Google Now, apparently, this is more of a leak or a rumor, but it seems seems like it would be totally legit, voice controls for media playback. So you can say, okay, Google, play the next song. This dovetails really nicely into Android Auto. It seems like the kind of voice command you'd want, particularly in your car. So you can do play next song, stop music. When you do okay, play next song, Google Now will also pop up a button. This hasn't rolled out yet, but there's a video and it looks like it probably still will. So good, nice stuff going on in Google Now as always. Speaking of voice, I didn't realize that you can do this, but this is a pretty neat little trick. You can correct Google's voice search interpretation by saying, no, I said. So if I say...
If only this worked on children.
Right, exactly. So if you say, okay, Google, tell me about this week in Google, and it takes me to this week in Boggle, I can say, okay, Google, no, I said Google, and it will actually correct the word that it screwed up, and I'm sure it's using some smarts to do that, and rerun the search. So you're seeing some of this kind of conversational functionality that we've seen, you know, what's the weather like in Santa Monica and how do I get there? And Google kind of associating, you know, the object from one search to the next in this. So try it out. It's less satisfying than just being able to say, no, I said. You actually have to say, okay, Google, no, I said. So it takes a little bit longer, but also kind of fun. So if Google messes up the search.
Sorry, Gina. Have you guys been using voice with your watch at all?
I have, yeah. I've been using it a lot. My watch, the battery actually died for the first time today, so I'm not wearing it right now. But I've been using it all the time.
It's not listening. It's not hearing me very well.
Really?
You know, how about you?
I use voice search so much that my 1-year-old now points to my watch and says Google.
That's what Google
is for her. Yes. Which is crazy, kind of scary and cool at the same time. I mean, I don't, out in public, I don't love saying, okay, Google, into my watch. I swipe over, you know, I just tap and swipe. Yeah. But it does a pretty good job of interpretation. Jeff, it doesn't hear you, like, or
it gets the wrong word. So I was outside in the street today when I did. I was sending an SMS back. I was meeting somebody in a car, and I said, almost there. And it said, fear. And I said, 1 minute, and it said 15 minutes. Now, how the hell it got 15 out of one, I don't know. So it's getting those misinterpretations.
It sounded like it was arguing with you.
Yeah,
what?
No, 15 minutes. I'm not ready in 1 minute.
I said 1 minute.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to be walking through the streets of Manhattan to find Jarvis going, no, I said in a minute.
Jeff, you need to move to a quieter place, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's like Petaluma next to your
there
oven.
You go.
So I love that, Gina, that Etta thinks that your watch is Google. Mommy, yes. Why are you talking to Google so much?
Google. Yeah, she pronounces Google more clearly than she pronounces grandma. Like, she has a hard time saying grandma. She says Gaga for grandma, but Google she knows. it's
grandma,
pretty
you are replaced by a robot.
She's going to get Lady Gaga playing on your phone if she's asking for grandma with that thing.
It's true,
but,
she is.
But isn't that an interesting image where this child is growing up in a world where some of its her first memories are going to be talking to a wristwatch, and that's normal. This is the normal world that she lives in.
Future babies, they are here. Yeah. I mean, she sees me talking to my watch, and she just wants to touch my watch. And I actually installed an app that locks my watch so that she can play with it without, you know, ordering me a car or something accidentally. Because she sees me, you know, playing with it, and that's what she wants to touch it. And she wants to put it on, and she says Google. I mean, it's the whole thing. It's really, it's amazing to watch, actually, because she's just mimicking right now.
Well, if a pizza shows up, you'll know where it came from.
I'll know why. Exactly.
But in fact, on Tech News Today this morning, we talked about a new product from LG called the Kizon, which is a children's smartwatch of sorts. It's essentially a cell phone wristwatch that does GPS tracking, so parents can track where their kids are, but it has 10 pre-programmed numbers. They push the button and they call the parents, or the parents can call the child. And even if the child doesn't answer after about 10 rings, it answers automatically. It has other features, waterproof and so on. But yeah, it looks like you can also tag and release your kids.
Teenager?
Teenager probably wouldn't wear it. It's very, very childy looking. Yeah, very Fisher Price-esque in its appearance. But
what's
funny
about that is young people don't talk on the phone.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
But text messaging.
That's right.
Yeah, text message, yes, but phone, no. Yeah. Dread it, hate it.
So what else you got, Gina?
What else we got here?
Let me see here.
Google Drive is getting a brand new interface redesign. I actually got this. This is rolling out slowly. You'll know if you got it if you go to drive.google.com, and you'll get a little prompt that says try the new web experience. It's just a really nice kind of overhaul. A new default view uses a thumbnail grid instead of a list. You can see file details from the home screen. You've got desktop style selection tools, including click and drag and control modifiers or drag and drop. It makes Google Drive feel a lot more like a desktop app. So again, this is rolling out slowly. You might not have it. It looks like Chad. Is that you, Chad? It looks like Chad's got it there.
I don't have it.
Yeah.
Just screenshots.
It looks really nice. Just screenshots.
Yeah.
Looks really nice. I'm digging it. What else we have? Oh, speaking of Google Drive, the Gmail app for Android phones and tablets just got a new insert Google Drive file command. So this is on Android. You got the Gmail app. You've got a compose window open. You go to insert a file into your email. You can select from Google Drive. If the file isn't shared with the person you're sending it to, and I always have this problem where I send people links to a Google Drive document. Yep. They don't have rights, and can you set the rights, and blah, blah, blah. Well, this new insert from Drive feature will let you know if the person doesn't have rights and let you change the sharing settings. So really easy way to send files, and not just directly from Drive. You can do that directly from Gmail now. And that update, I have not gotten that update yet, but that update is rolling out to Gmail on Android now. An update to the official Chromecast app for Android now has been updated to allow streaming your device's entire screen to your home. So excited about this. This is such a cool new feature. So basically, you're in your Chromecast app. If you flip out the hamburger menu, like Chad's showing on the screen there, there's an option to cast screen. This new feature is limited to certain devices right now: the Nexus 4, the Nexus 5, the Nexus 7, 2013, the Nexus 10, the Samsung Galaxy S4, S5, Note 3, Note 10, the HTC One M7, which made me very sad because I have the M8, the LG Pro 2, the LG 2, and the LG 3. I think they're rolling this out. I'm not sure why, actually, they're rolling this out to certain devices first. There must be some hardware dependencies going on here. But yeah, really, really neat way to show off what's going on your phone on your Chromecast cast a screen.
Isn't that related to what we saw at I/O where you could show your Android screen onto a TV?
Yeah, that exactly. That's right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what it does. It just casts a screen.
It's the first step.
You can show off what's going on. This is the first step, exactly. And that update is also rolling out with the Chromecast app for Android right now. And finally, this got me really excited because this is an Android Wear thing. There's a new update to the Google Camera app for Android that allows you to use your watch as a remote shutter.
Wow.
Okay?
Whoa.
Yeah, this is really cool. And I got to try this out. This is such a neat use of Android Wear. So the way that it works is you got your phone, which is connected, of course, to your watch through Bluetooth. You initiate the camera app. You launch the camera app, and a card shows up on your watch that says, you know, tap here for remote shutter. It counts down 3, 2, 1, and then you see a preview of the device on your screen. So really, really, really cool way to take remote photos with your phone. My only nitpick, I mean, this would be an amazing selfie function if you could preview the viewfinder, you know, on your watch before you take the image. You can't. You only see the image on your watch after you take the image. But still really neat use of Android Wear as a remote shutter. For those of you considering jumping into Android Wear early, really fun.
Before you hit it, while you're on Android Wear, have you guys discovered any great new Android Wear apps?
Well, there's actually a Flappy Bird clone that now exists on Android Wear called Flopsy Droid. And it's as bad as it sounds. There's a little Android robot that flies around. But no, I haven't seen a good one.
I've got a good calculator.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Very cool. Well, Baby Time is the one that I use to lock my device so that my child can't, SMS nice. China.
Jason needs that one.
Yeah, Jason, I'm sure. I knew Jason would go for that one. And I installed Flopsy Droid, which I am sorry to say, as I said last night on All About Android, is very playable. Much more playable
I'm
than
so
I wished that it was. Yeah,
ooh,
it's very
that.
Playable.
Wow.
Playable. That's my, a good calculator. Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah, you just, you know, numbers around and
calculator.
Very nice.
Yeah,
here come
great.
The apps, man. This is great. This is really exciting. This is
I want better looking faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things you'd think that'd be the first thing that, that would come before Flapsy Droid. Better Places.
Well, Flapsy Droid was a third party developer,
right,
who did it. And it actually was, I mean, I just, it never occurred to me that I would want to play games on the watch. It was actually kind of a neat proof of concept. I didn't think that a game would be playable on a screen that small, and yet there it is.
There it is.
It's sort of the beauty of Flappy Bird, right?
And you can probably play that while you're holding your baby, right? You're sort of holding the baby like this, and you can kind of...
Oh, man, I got to show her Flapsy Droid. I haven't shown her Flapsy Droid yet. Well, I'm in big trouble.
All right, so...
And that's all I got for the changelog.
All right, wonderful. That is the Google changelog. So we got a couple of stories here about people complaining about Google search and Google's sort of internal processes for dealing with errors and problems, one of which appeared on Wired, wired.com, and by Kevin Paulson. It's called How Google Map Hackers Can Destroy a Business at Will. And according to this article, there was a Serbian restaurant that Google misreported the hours of operations for in the Washington, D.C. area. This is a restaurant, by the way, that serves lion meat. I have to check that out if they ever come back. But anyway, the misreported hours caused, according to the owner of this restaurant, caused them to go out of business. And it said that they weren't open on the weekends and so on. And so the Serbian Crown restaurant sort of declined into poverty and obsolescence because Google misreported the hours. Is this just somebody whining their business went out of business for reasons like they serve lion meat, for example, instead of meat that the general population wants to eat? Or is this legitimate that Google has way too much power and they have the ability to crush businesses with their little errors? What do you think, Jeff or Gina?
I'm confused. I thought that as a local business listing that you had control over or that you could update your business listing. Is that not true? Do you need to submit it to Google and wait for them to... I mean, I don't understand why these folks couldn't just update the hours.
Yeah, I don't either, right?
Yeah, I don't either. And I was under that impression as well. Maybe this wasn't possible in his case for some reason we don't know about. But that was my impression as well, that you could just go in there and maybe there was a dispute. Maybe the other Serbian restaurant across town was changing their results.
So the story is not very complete in answering those, I think, pretty obvious questions.
That's
What I find interesting in this, though, it's not as if, how do I put this? I mean, the guy, as I understand, didn't pay for the service. He's just saying Google listed me wrong.
Yeah.
And he built the business apparently on the back of Google existing. And so, you know, do you then have some right to be listed correctly? Is it a violation of your rights if you're listed incorrectly, if somebody makes a mistake? If a newspaper, I guess the analogy would be if a newspaper runs an ad and puts in the wrong time for your show, then you get to sue the newspaper at least for the money back for your ad or the business lost. If the newspaper puts in a free listing, the show starts at 8 when it starts at 7. Do you have a case against them? Newspaper screwed up. Well, gee, but the only way we're going to get, you know, people to our show that way. Well, that's true. And the newspaper screwed up, and that's too bad.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that there's a basis for suit.
Well, you mentioned listing a show coming in on at the wrong time. The other story that falls in this category is that Dinesh D'Souza's new film called America was confused on Google's listings with his previous movie called something or other, using the word America. And as a result of that, the database showed that the movie wasn't playing in theaters when in fact it was, because his old movie wasn't playing in theaters. And so he turned the screws on Google in the court of public opinion and said that essentially that Google and... You guys are going to laugh at this. Google is a left-leaning organization that was deliberately doing this to prevent his right-leaning movie from being popular or something like that. So,
yeah, big giant Google sat down and said, you know, we want to stop that Dinesh to what's-his-name's movie.
Yeah.
Let's bring all of our huge and vast power behind stopping it.
Yeah. I think a more likely...
Of course. That's ridiculous. That is of course ridiculous. But I do try in these cases to kind of I don't know, be empathetic to the person, you know, the less powerful party. I mean, so it looks like in this case with this particular Lion Meats restaurant, this fellow immigrated from the U.S., from Northern Italy. You know, he's 74 years old. He doesn't own a computer. He'd heard of the internet, but didn't really know much about Google and didn't use Google, didn't realize that this was happening. And I guess his accountant called Google and tried to change the listing. I called them. How do you call Google? Eventually he hired an internet consultant to get it fixed. But by that time, his business was in a nosedive. He decided that this was Google's fault, and hence the suit. So this is sort of just like, you know, lack of awareness going on here. Yep. But for a filmmaker or for someone who makes something, listen, Jeff's an author. I'm an author. I mean, you know, when you make something or you make a site particularly or an app, I mean, in a lot of ways, Google is the way that people find you. And it is frustrating. And I've been in this position. Yeah. It is frustrating when Google's snippets or search results or whatever show something that you know is untrue or out of date or misleading. And, you know, that whole process, there really isn't a process to appeal that, right? I mean, all you can do is kind of go in and try to tweak your copy and get more links and, like, hope for the best. And, you know, while there's, like, a whole industry of SEO people trying to, you know, get high on the search results, I do feel for the folks who have a legitimate case of, like, hey, you got this wrong. Your algorithm is wrong, and I'm one of the, you know, casualties. But is that Google's responsibility? No,
it's hard to say. In the case of the D'Souza thing, I mean, I don't know how common this is, but in his case, you know, Google did make an error, and I think he seized on the opportunity to get
a
whole
lot of
attention.
Though? Was that an error, or the problem is that you know, if your name John Smith,
yeah,
it's going to be hard to be found on Google, and if you really want to be found, then you've got to go through a whole bunch of steps to say, no, I'm the John Smith you really care about. America as a title of a show. I'm not trying to defend Google here, but I don't know what it's the same as the guy with the lime meat. Which, by the way, I think serving lime meat is a nasty thing, and I'm not sure that I'm
tastes like chicken.
Happy with him anyway. You know, we don't know enough to know. People just say, it's all Google's fault. Maybe it is. Maybe Google messed up, and maybe it's impossible to get to Google, and that's an issue for Google. However, it is a behemoth, and there are just ways you have to deal with this. It's like, you know, it's kind of a new DMV, and you got to deal with the rules, and you got to deal with the factor. And we don't know enough to know who is in the wrong in this case. But I certainly don't think there was a conspiracy to get rid of either party.
Yeah, neither do I. Falls into the category of when organizations, tech companies have so much power. And, you know, right now they probably have, what, 80% of the search engine traffic market share, whatever you want to call it, in the United States. What if they had 99%? You know, it's an interesting question, but let's move on from that whole issue because it's a total bummer, frankly. All these stories we've talked about so far. Let's talk about something really awesome, which is that NASA is using Project Tango as robot eyes for these little soccer ball sized robots that are going to do EVAs on the space station. And this is scheduled to blast off. What is it? Day after tomorrow, on Friday, to go up to the space station. And these newly, Project Tango-oriented robots are going to be put into immediate use. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Project Tango, this is an experimental project that builds 3D mapping into a smartphone. They also have a tablet version that they're working on. But essentially, it has special hardware and software that enables, in the normal use case, you walk around a room and it instantly maps or very quickly maps the entire indoor space, all the furniture, where the ceiling is, where the walls are, where the doors are, where the windows are, and you can do all kinds of cool interactive things. App developers will be able to do all kinds of amazing things, but NASA is going to use it. They bolted it onto this robot. They've integrated it electronically, so now Project Tango phones are actually controlling the little CO2 jets where these circular robots fly around in zero Gs. They're going to deploy them out the chute of the space station, and they're going to fly around on the exterior, mapping the exterior of the space station. Sounds really, really cool.
This is awesome. This is just awesome. Yeah. How cool is this? I just love this. In an attempt to make the robots smarter used to astronauts, engineers at NASA's Ames Research Center sent cheap smartphones to the space station, which they had purchased from Best Buy. I mean, listen, when we live in an amazing world where NASA is heading over to Best Buy to equip their robots with some extra smarts to, like, map the space station. That's incredible. That is incredible.
It really is. It really is. And what's also incredible is the fact that this technology is moving so quickly into a usable form. I mean, when I first heard about this technology, I thought, okay, you know, 2020, we're going to start seeing something like this come out. But it's really, you know, I believe it's LG. I could be getting this wrong, but I think LG is actually going to ship a consumer tablet later this year or next year. I'm sorry I don't have the facts. We reported on Tech News Today some time ago, but it's actually going to be a commercially available consumer product that can map an indoor space like this. And I think that, you know, there's got to be some kind of partnership with Google where they're really, they want the public and the developers to know that this is going to be out there. And so for, you know, people to create apps for this sort of technology, and obviously games are going to be killer on this thing.
Yeah, for definitely.
Yeah. So
plus, well, you know, and the applications, you know, every time you see one of these things and you wonder what's behind it with Google, right? So my first presumption is they can map a room, right? Then I think we talked on the show about, wow, would this be amazing for a blind person to know what's what in a room? Mm-hmm. And I kind of never thought of that idea of how do you deal with something that's in space where you really don't know, you have no bearings at all, and it can start to virtually map what it's going to go deal with. I mean, how phenomenal.
It's absolutely incredible. I love this technology, and I love the fact that, you know, usually NASA, you know, it's they're awesome, but usually it takes them a long time to get stuff implemented. Here they are with a very, you know, prototypical thing that pretty much we heard about very recently, and they're already deploying it. It's just a great, great thing.
Well, of course, then, because NASA's doing it, we should nationalize LG.
Yes.
And Best Buy.
And Google.
And Google.
Immediately. Well, let's.
And Tang.
I think, and any store that's on a public street.
That's right. Was Tang ever nationalized? That was always private, I think. Anyway, that didn't really work out the way they thought. It turns out.
I want to bake Tang in your oven, Mike, but as we're getting off on another topic.
Tang flavored bread. I actually made bread recently with grape seeds, grape seed flour and regular flour together. That was interesting, but I haven't thought about Tang.
How did it taste?
It tasted great. It didn't taste that different, actually. The color was different. It was slightly brownish purple, which was interesting. Oh. There were Pinot grape seeds. It had a slightly different flavor, but it was, you know, it worked out fine, and it was interesting. So anyway, when you're in the wine country, that's the kind of crazy thing you get inspired to do because they have that stuff for sale. So let's do our tip, tool, and number of the week. Gina, why don't we start with you?
Yes. So I think my tip, was last week how to get to the old Google Maps. Well, this week I've got a tip for something that only works in the new Google Maps. You can, and I didn't know this, and this is thanks to Gizmodo, you can measure distances, just kind of doodle on a map if you want in the new Google Map. The new Google Maps were you know, in any location, and you right click, is that correct? Yeah, right-click your starting point and you choose measure distance. You can just start drawing lines on the map and Google will tell you what the distance is from one line to the other, so you can see how far things as the crow flies or in any sort of route that you want to take. Or, you know, you can just draw something cool on the map just for fun. Really, really neat. And when you drop, you can drop as many points as you want in when you draw, and you can, you know, click and drag any point to adjust it as well to get the adjusted distances.
That is cool. That is really cool. That's also great for setting up a route for running and jogging, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Nice job. Nice job, Chad. Yeah. Chad did, like, as the crow flies, it looks like from Twit to In-N-Out.
Yep, I wanted to know how far it would be for a drone, to get, and then if the drone needed to be carried back, because it probably won't have power. There we go.
Or for running, if you calculate the distance and then you figure out the number of calories burned by running and then match that against the calories in the burger, you could decide whether you could, like, zero it out.
Yeah, this works really well. I mean, there's also, if you grab the starting position, you can drag it around, and you can see that it has a cool, really, animation on how
long. Yeah, that is really neat.
This is a cool feature. Very neat.
Demo chat.
Somebody did that for a living.
Wow. How fun. That's cool. I got to try that. never done that before. So I'm going to do mine very quickly, and then we'll end with Jeff's spectacular number of the week. First, I have two things. I have a tool of the week and a toy of the week. The tool of the week came to me right at the last minute. Patrick told me about it. It's a new Twit fan-created Chrome app that shows you the live Twit stream. It's the same thing you get on live.twit.tv, but it shows it to you as a Chrome app, and it's on top of your other windows. So as you're working, as you're moving windows around, it'll always stay on top so you can watch the Twit
network.
Because,
of course, there is nothing more important than watching Twit.
That is,
so it should always be atop everything else. Bravo.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So check that out. You can find that, by the way, at twit.tv/apps. There is a section called Laptop or Desktop, and it's the last item
in the
or Desktop section. Yeah, look at all those apps. Those are all Twit-related apps. And it shows you which ones show you live, which ones show you recorded, and so
God
on.
God bless the fans.
Yeah.
Not one of those is made by Twit, I believe, right?
Every one of those is
made by fans.
Pretty sure that's correct.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. So never
nationalize
stop,
them all.
Nationalize them. Never stop watching Twit. But my actual item is what I'm calling the toy of the week. So we all went to Google I.O. They gave us these things, this is a Google Cardboard. This is a open source project that gives you 3D in an app in your phone. You put the phone inside. You look at it like a viewfinder. It shows you 3D. There's several apps that came with it, and other people are creating more apps. It's a really cool project. Unfortunately, if you didn't go to Google I.O., you didn't get one. And then we've talked in previous shows about companies like Dodo, which makes cases like this is my iPad case. They make really nice cases, among other things. But Dodo actually immediately went on sale and said that they were going to be selling cardboard versions of this. But the wait is 4 to 6 weeks. So if you're impatient, there's a quicker way to get your hands on one of these. And that is something called the Unofficial Cardboard. The Unofficial Cardboard is the name of the product that they're selling. It's $29.99, and they will send you something that looks a lot like the one that Google gave out at Google I.O. It has a couple of lenses in it, a magnetic controller, a rubber band, and it's a cardboard, viewfinder thing. It'll come fully assembled, or you can also choose to get it the unassembled version.
Oh, it was too much fun watching Gina assemble it. You want to go to that fun.
Yeah, get the unassembled version. Yeah, that's a good one. And, of course, this works with most Android phones. If you go to the Unofficial Cardboard site or several other sites that talk about Google Cardboard, they'll tell you which phones these work with and which they don't. Most major Android phones works great with Moto X, for example. And this is just a really fun and really cheap, $30, and you have, like, 3D. And not only 3D, but it's motion-controlled 3D. You have to experience it. And at these prices, I highly recommend it. So that is my toy of the week. And Jeff, you have a number.
Well, I have a couple. I just want to mention before we get started that our dear Twig friend Matt Cutts is, after 15 years at Google, said, well, it's one of those very Matt moments. He just announced that he's taking a few months off to be with his wife and do what he wants to do. And I think we wanted to give a salute to our dear friend Matt. And I can't think of anybody who deserves a break more. And we expect him to come back soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that the post that we see on the screen here was really funny. He's like, no, really, I just wanted to spend some time with my family. Everybody says, when there's some problem that they're going to spend time with their family. No, really, he just wants to spend some time with his family. It's true.
He's the one guy I believe.
Yeah, right.
All right, exactly. A couple quick numbers real quick. Google Cloud Storage is going to offer 2 terabytes of storage per year free to its customers. Point of that being that the cost of storage is heading towards zero. Rapidly. 2 terabytes for nothing is phenomenal. Second number, 35.6 million tweets about the Germany-Brazil game in the World Cup, most popular for a sports game ever. But the number of the week I wanted to do was this one. Google just spent $600 million on real estate just in Mountain View.
Yeah.
And that also speaks to the value of real estate in Mountain View. I probably got them 2 sheds, but... that amazes me and the amount of space that Google needs. And it almost makes me wonder about whether, given all the hell Google's getting because of the buses in San Francisco, I started fantasizing after I read this of Google condos.
Yeah.
Right. So imagine you start to really live in the company store. What would Google apartments be like? Wouldn't that be the coolest thing? Wouldn't you work for them just so you could live in one? They're not doing that with this real estate, but I wish they would. I wish they'd build, and then you can imagine the sitcom about living with Google all day long.
Right.
There'd be probably no garbage. There'd be robots.
You'd have slides instead of stairs. You'd
exactly.
sleep in a pod.
I sort of imagine a Roomba with Project Tango tablet kind of mounted to it, just constantly indexing your stuff.
Yeah. Don't you want this? Right?
Self-driving flying cars to go from sky. So one of the thing that I started fantasizing about, because apparently, according to this article, Google is interested in building buildings that are taller than what's allowed by Mountain View law, and they're working on changing those laws. And I personally think that Silicon Valley ought to have lots of skyscrapers. I mean, I think that the value of real estate is so high. There's so many people who want to live there. Earthquake technology is so good these days that you can build all kinds of tall buildings. And why not? These communities used to be lovely orchard farming communities. Nowadays, for the most part, they're a bunch of strip malls and track housing. They're not. Yeah. It's Silicon Valley is not a pretty place. It's okay, but it's not something that's precious and needs to be preserved. I'd rather see the Jetson City of the future erected in Mountain View.
Yeah, and you support some more residential to the outside of San Francisco. Then do you deflate some of the issues there? You support more offices down there. You know, is that an issue? I think it has some opportunity. But Google just keeps growing and growing and growing. I also think there's something too, though. We're very happy to have a large Google office here in New York, and I think the part of the answer for Google and all of San Francisco fight is also to have more people elsewhere than the Valley.
Yeah, that's true as well. And of course, Apple's really upped the ante with their spaceship campus, which is well underway now. The construction is happening. The circular floor plan has already been built. And when that thing is done, it's supposed to be done next year. I don't believe it. I think it'll probably be done 2016, 2017, something like that. But when it's done, it's going to be amazing. And I think that Google's going to want to step it up and have a spectacular campus to match it. Right now, Google probably has the coolest campus in the Valley. The Googleplex, they have big dinosaur statues, and you know, it's a really cool place to be. But when Apple's spaceship goes live, I think Google's going to want to step it up, and I hope the city of Mountain View lets them build whatever they want. I'd be curious to see what they do.
And by the way, Apple, to its credit, its swag store is open to the public. Google's, you have to get an escort in there. Facebook's, you have to get an escort in. I think these companies are all missing a beat not having public swag stores.
Yeah,
I want to go to the mall.
That's true.
Well, Apple knows how to do retail. That's for sure.
Yes, they
that's
do.
True.
They do secrecy, but they also do retail. And that's the difference.
Their campus is actually going to let them up the secrecy, because right now there are all these leaks that are caused by people taking pictures of the banners that they put up at Moscone in San Francisco before they do an event. Future events are going to take place on the campus underground.
And oh, so, really?
Yes.
And so I didn't know that piece.
And that'll also enable them to have events that are unscheduled. Right now, you have to book Moscone like 2 years in advance or something like that. In the future, they'll be able to basically put out a press release and saying, we're announcing something at 2 o'clock. And, of course, the Silicon Valley press will come rushing in, and they'll announce and surprise.
That's everyone. A huge amount of floor space to just have in case. Wow.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Underground parking, lots of stuff. That's going to be a really cool campus. Everybody focuses in on the fact that there's a big, gigantic circular building with these crazy opening and closing windows and stuff like that. The coolest stuff is this kind of underground. They have a whole underground freeway under this thing. So it's going to be a really great campus. Well, that is Twig. I want to thank everyone for coming on the show today and joining us today. Jeff Jarvis, professional of journalism at the City University of New York, author of Public Parts, What Would Google Do? And Gutenberg the Geek. And Jeff blogs at buzzmachine.com. Thank you so much, Jeff. And thanks for sprinting into your office. I think you had to break into your office with a crowbar, right?
No, I had to break into the network with a crowbar, but that's another story.
All right. And Gina Trapani, creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twits All About Android, and the founding editor of Lifehacker. And we got a little bit of Lifehacker trivia today. That was cool.
We did. Yeah. We did. Thank you so much, Mike. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you.
Great. Thank you for covering while Leo's been out.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. You know, I said this about Twit the other day, but Leo makes this look so easy, and it's not. And it's a testament to how well he does the show and all of his shows. So I can't wait till he comes back. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. That's 2000 UTC. You can watch the show live at live.twit.tv. You can also watch the show live with the new Chrome app. You can find that on twit.tv/apps, or you can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/Twig. Thank you for joining us today. Leo and the gang will see you next time on Twig.